Okay, we're back on Can't Wait. I'm Rusty Boulay-Stevenson, and I'm here with the brothers Milner. We've covered cheating in sports. We're going to talk to you right now about sports video games. The ones we love, why we love them, maybe some nostalgia looking back at spending time doing it. So let's, I don't know how we really want to start this. We could start with talking just about our favorite video games in general.
Yeah, I think I'm going to, before I get into my favorite sports video game memories, I think one thing that's really important to note, and it's certainly true for my brother and I, is that I think that our age is like right in the sweet spot of having really grown up as sports video games were coming into their own.
Yeah. Mm. Madden 94 was the first that we owned.
Yeah. Yep. And and that was a great game. And that Absolutely. And it's considered one of the best Maddens, I think.
White Emmett Smith was fantastic.
Yeah, he was really great. The key was, for anyone who's still playing Madden 94 on the Super Nintendo,
we have a lot out there, I think.
Yeah, I think this is a probably pretty big demographic of our listeners, but the key is you just do the inside handoff with Emmett Smith, but then you actually bounce to the outside. The defense never figures it out. So, all of my memories of watching sports are inextricably tied to playing video games as well. And, you know, I don't really have many memories of watching sports before we could fire up the Super Nintendo and play, you know, the era's equivalent. And obviously, as we got older and as they developed more, they move from being kind of arcade style to being, you know, remarkably realistic. But I'm not sure if our level of enjoyment changed that much, you know, regardless of what the technology level at the time was. I think that it still was, in many ways to me, at least growing up, I enjoyed playing sports video games, certainly more than I enjoyed playing sports, but also more than I enjoyed watching sports, even because of the kind of communal aspect of it, of you're with your friends or your family or whatever, you have control over the outcome. And as a result, I guess my favorite sports video games are the ones that I have the most specific memories of playing with large groups of people.
Oh, that's nice. Now, mine goes back a little further. I'm a little older than you guys. I'll be turning 42. But I still had video games all the way through all of my sports enjoyment. We had the original Atari 2600. Huh. Now, those games, we had basketball for the 2600. We had football for the 2600. But, I mean, they were so archaic, especially when you look at it now. And they weren't really good simulations of... There was a Tommy Lasorda baseball that was really supposed to be great for the Atari, but even that, I mean, it was just not real baseball. It was hard to really get much enjoyment. The basketball was probably the easiest to play, the basketball and the football. Mm-hmm. But it was fun. I mean, you could control your football as you passed it. You could control it through the air with your joystick, which was pretty interesting. So you could glide around, you know, opposing players and... But it wasn't until the NES came out where I really started loving some sports baseball games, and I have a lot of great memories of all those games. But I think you guys are right. I think that it's the communal aspect. It's bringing my friends together. We could play, and we could be these players that we never could be. We would play basketball in the driveway, and we'd play some softball or baseball, but we weren't great athletes by any means. And so sports is where you could get that a little bit, right? And have that communal aspect with your friends. And I was, like you guys, I was much more apt to play video games than to play sports on a daily basis. So to me, NES is where I kind of start. And one of the great ones, we had boxing, we talked about it and said we might not talk about it again. But Mike Tyson's Punch-Out is so culturally relevant.
Oh, sure.
And so much a part of video game lore. One of the things that was great about Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, of the myriad things that were great about it, was the fact that you learned about these boxer styles.
Right.
Like, you learned their personalities, and you knew Glass Joe by his name. I mean, he was going to fall down easy. But, I mean, you know, when Bald Bull would come charging at you, you'd know you have to duck that and then punch him, mm-hmm. you know? And it was really great. So did Popinski with his spinning around and... pretty awful stereotype, but
right.
or group of stereotypes. Sure. He was like six stereotypes rolled into one.
Right. I'm more familiar with the Simpsons parody of the Mike Tyson punch-out game.
Oh, wow.
Because the I remember that it has the exact same structure. You know, like aesthetically it's very similar, but also that you're going through the progression of different kind of stereotypical boxers of different styles before you ultimately like make it up to the impossible kind of Mike Tyson stand-in. Mm-hmm. But it's true though that even though that game was a little bit before our time, I've played the game and I'm very familiar with just the mechanics of it, and I think that it probably is without a doubt the most iconic boxing game of all time, and it came out 25 years ago?
Yeah, I think that's about right. That's even a little further back, maybe.
Yeah.
But and it was originally an arcade game without Mike Tyson.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was just called Super Punch-Out.
Huh.
And Super Punch-Out had a few of the characters. It had Sandman as the champion. And I forget who he was based on, but he had the Sandman, and he was tough to beat, but you could do it, and then you would go back through, and then you would fight everybody again.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't quite the same setup that Mike Tyson's Punch-Out was, where once you beat Mike Tyson, the game's over, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the end of
that's
the game.
The end.
And, well, you go around dancing up and down the streets and telling your friends.
Right.
But beyond that, the game is over at that point.
And, you know, it's an interesting turning point, though. So when you start to get into the Super Nintendo and the Sega, like that era of gaming. What are the 16-bit systems? Is that
yes,
how that
that's
works?
Right.
Yeah, okay. That's the point, I think, when you start to have not only are the player models more recognizable as players. Tim did reference accurately that even in that Madden 94, all the players are white, which,
yep.
They remedied that eventually. But... But no, I mean, at that point, though, I remember, I mean, it feeling like from Madden 94, going back to it, at the time, it felt so realistic. You know, even though all the players were white and they were all the same size and the same shape.
Yeah.
But just the
idea
that...
They were all pretty stocky.
They were all pretty stocky, yeah. But the idea that you could select the plays, you know, and that you could control any player on the field, and that, you know, it still approximated the rhythm of a football game. And I suppose that... The part that stuck out with me the most back then was the idea that I knew even then I was never going to be a football player. I was never going to be a coach. I was never going to be a GM. That ship had sailed even by the time I was 6 years old. but there's that fantasy aspect of it, of being able to live out like your wildest dream of, you know, of controlling, and whether your dream is to be a player or a GM or a coach or whatever it is, to be able to participate in that fantasy is the thing that has kept bringing me back to sports video games over the years.
And I think for the two of us, especially as brothers, part of what developed a great competition between us was not just figuring out who is better at playing the game, but piggybacking off of what you just said and sort of living out those fantasies of we enjoyed figuring out who was best at every aspect of that, of the GM aspect, the coach aspect, the playing aspect itself. We would do NBA Courtside 2 with Kobe Bryant for the N64. Mm. Was the first game that I remember being able to do the fantasy draft, essentially, to redraft the teams. And so the way that we would play together wasn't just let's pick our two favorite teams and play. It was let's draft our teams, let's come up with our own strategy, and then play. So on multiple levels, we're trying to best each other.
And honestly, we probably did 200 drafts in that game, at least, if not more, to the point where we were still able last night to rattle off, you know, all of our favorite like bench players and which round they usually went in and what made them all so great.
Wow.
Tim correctly recognized that I would always go for Sam Perkins in the like 11th or 12th round.
Than that, you needed Sam Perkins somewhere between like the 6th and 8th round.
Oh, really?
For your backup. Basically.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we realized though, and this is something that I guess I'd never thought about till we were getting ready for this segment. But even before the whole analytics revolution in basketball, where you have like the Daryl Morey method now of you know, the Rockets being the best example, that you're trying to have the most efficient offense possible, and the most efficient places on the court to score from are at the hoop or from behind the three-point line. The mid-range jumpers are, you know, inefficient. So you build your offense around getting to the hoop and shooting threes. We were intuitively aware of that reality, even playing, you know, 12 or 13 years ago, and it was not a product of us being these great strategic geniuses. It was a product of the fact that if you were not able to run sophisticated plays in which your shooters would run off of a screen to get open for an 18-foot jump shot, you know, you had to kind of settle for whatever would be the simplest way to get points, which is either get guys who can dunk or guys who can shoot threes. And weirdly enough, that has, you know, that was a constant, whatever era we were in, of our basketball video game strategies. And now it's, you know, the paradigm of great offense today.
I think that a mini basketball revolution occurred over the course of us playing those games, where it wasn't long until we figured out that we needed to, in those draft picks, compete over who was getting the best three-point shooters.
Oh, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Who was getting the best dunkers, because that was the most efficient way to win the game.
Yeah. Rusty, what's your most vivid memory of a sports video game experience that you had, whether it's a single game or your relationship with a specific game?
Well, I'll tell you, it's the relationship with the game, and it goes right along with what you guys were saying, in that from the NES until like Super Nintendo, the thing that changed from the Nintendo is the Nintendo, there were only a couple games where you could save information. Mm-hmm. And so so those games were huge to me, because you couldn't ever save it and play over and over again.
Yeah.
You had to play all at once. And once the Super Nintendo and other systems started coming out, you could keep stats.
Right.
And that we loved as video game players. For me, I mean, the stats were the thing, you know, and it was so cool to see if I played a season that my stats would build up.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I loved that. Well, there was a game called All-Star Baseball for the NES that allowed you to keep your team. It had a battery built into the cartridge.
Wow.
So it would keep your team. And not only did you keep your stats over the course of a season, you could have like four teams play against each other and have these round robin games. But your teams, as you won games, you earned money and could build up your player attributes.
Mm.
And so that was very, very exciting. And
yeah.
It had other features, like you could climb the wall to rob people of home runs and some really great diving plays at shortstop and second. But another thing that we loved was the fact that you could name your players. You got to name them. That was never allowed before. You could never do it because you couldn't save anything, so it didn't matter if you did. And so, you know, we had Eazy-E and Dre and Bill and Ted and Rufus.
Right.
And I remember Batman being on my team, you know, because as a teenage kid or 12-year-old or whatever,
sure.
That's great.
Right.
I mean, having Batman on your team. So that, and playing with my friends and my brother, I mean, those. That game, All-Star Baseball, I mean, we still talk about it to this day. What a great and revolutionary kind of thing it was, because you could save and because you could keep adding to your stats.
Yeah.
And as a nerd, I love that.
Tim, what's your most vivid memory?
Well, a couple come to mind, but really when you talk about naming the players, what comes to mind for me is that in the 2K series, when they briefly had college basketball, they got in on it late, and then Ed O'Bannon ripped it away from them. So they weren't in the game long, but when they were especially good at the college basketball games. And of course, while you were still allowed to make a college basketball game, the players did not have names. They were just a number, but it was their likeness and their skill set. And I specifically remember, I believe it was 2K5 of the March Madness games, that I went through with a computer by my side in the living room and pulling up the rosters of each team. I went through and I entered the name of every single player in college basketball.
Wow.
All the way down from the power conferences to the absolute lowest, the teams that we never, ever played with. I went through and I named every single one of them. I would say it was 10 hours of work would be a minimum. It had to have been much, much more than that. I think I spent every every night coming home from school for weeks and weeks, I would devote, I would devote an hour or two where I would just put on some music and I would just sit there and enter my players.
Right. And then the fascinating thing to me about that is to what end? You know what I mean? Because, like, I remember that it started with you doing it for the teams that you, and your friends were playing. So, like, obviously for Arizona, you put in the names of the guys and for the, you know, the other power teams that people were gravitating towards. And that's logical because it's just more fun. And it also makes it easier to know if you're familiar with the rosters. Instead of having to memorize numbers, you know, like, okay, well, Mustafa Shakur's got it right now. But what compels you to go down to the point where, you know, even in the Horizon League, you know, you had every single player?
Well, I think that initially the biggest aspect is sort of what you touched upon, and also going back on some of the earlier parts of this segment, is that when we get into that innate desire to emulate these players and what they're doing and live out these fantasies that we cannot, it's more real if I have their names. Mm-hmm. It is less real when they are a number. In terms of why I felt the need to complete it down to the Horizon League, that more is in line with probably just a neurotic completionist right. tendency. That part's harder to justify. I don't have a good excuse.
I don't think you need to justify it here, Tim.
Your other great accomplishment, though, is similar in its single-mindedness.
Yeah, and I think that they're interesting in that you have the parallel of the completionist aspect of them, but one being more of a community-driven project and the other being a very solitary project. Matt's referring to that my other great undertaking was for my favorite of the N64 baseball games was Ken Griffey Jr. Slugfest. And I devoted a summer to playing an entire season, not simming a single game, playing all 162 games with one specific team and the playoffs, winning the World Series. I obviously met well exceeded the record for games won in a season. But, you know, that was a task that it came about from sort of the obsession with a bit of what you talked about, Rusty, with I loved getting to observe my stats over the course of the season. I loved getting to watch David Cone's ERA change over the course of 5 games, 10 games. And so it was the idea of, well, what happens if I play every single game in the season?
Yeah. And I remember it was work. Like, it wasn't.
Yeah. It was. I would get home from work or school. Well, I got to go put in a couple hours getting through some games.
Yeah. Oh, that's hilarious. I love that, Tim. But I totally identify with it. I mean, and that's, I still, like, there's a lot we could get into with video games and sports. We could talk about this for days.
Sure.
But I do think that there's something really great about just the stats aspect of it and the completionist aspect of it. Also, they do become, you almost like know them, right? Like you take them into your hearts a little bit, like David Cone you're mentioning. And so I think that I still will play the franchise mode very gladly.
Oh, yeah.
For that exact reason. I mean, I love the franchise modes in games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, you know, touching on the stats, that in terms of the stats, the strategy, how much it's affected the way that we watch the game outside of video games, the real game, how much it's affected the way that we watch and perceive it is fascinating to me when you think about Madden culture, FIFA culture, the way that we can more easily identify that's a nickel defense, that's a dime defense.
Yes.
Where someone mm-hmm. who hasn't played those games is going to have a tougher time picking out that there are extra DBs on the field right now. Or mm-hmm. in FIFA, in watching a soccer match, that it looks like they're lined up in a 4-2-3-1 with inverted wingers and playing a high-pressing game. But if you've played FIFA and you've made those adjustments and you've seen what it looks like on the screen and what it felt like to do it, you can more easily pick up those things when you're watching the actual product.
Absolutely. And I think that as the games have gotten more realistic, it's gotten to a point now where I think that playing these sports video games, whether it's playing the actual games or doing the franchise mode, both of those, I think actually are probably the best entry point that you could have into learning about,
learning
the strategy, learning about, you know, the balance of power in the league. I mean, to take the, the NBA 2K games as an example, even somebody who had never watched basketball in their entire life, I think could learn just from playing those games and from, you know, seeing how the rosters are constructed and understanding, you know, what it means when you hit the pick and roll button and how mm-hmm. all of that operates. You could, I think, pretty much develop a knowledge of the game that would be not that far different than somebody who grew up watching basketball and observing it through a more traditional lens. And especially now that you've got commentators in all of the games as well. Yeah. I mean, it's really not that different than watching a game. It really isn't.
And it's made us more critical. You know, we've become more intense armchair coaches and armchair GMs in that, you know, we get this attitude of, well, I was able to figure it out with that team.
Right.
I was able to figure out how to maximize that player best given what his unique skill set is. How come you haven't?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I tell you what, there's a game, NHL 94 for the Sega Genesis, a really great game. It introduced one-timers into hockey, but I was not a hockey fan in any way until that game came out and I got it, and it was so much fun, and you start learning the nuances of hockey, and I became a hockey fan and started watching hockey. Not a lot, but I mean, I had never watched before, and just because I got a video game all at once now, I knew what was happening in the game. I understood the line changes.
Sure.
I understood so much of what was happening in the game that I never had a sense of before.
I didn't know I cared. I think if you took someone who was totally new to the game and you gave them the option between watching a hockey game and playing a hockey video game and said, you need to know the rules by the end of this exercise,
right?
I think they should probably go with the video game.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's a whole generation as well. I mean, this is almost its own topic, but the rise of soccer in America, I think, has directly paralleled the rise in popularity of the FIFA video game. And I don't think that the rise of the video game's popularity is the result of the rising popularity in general. I think that in many ways it's the opposite. I think that FIFA as a game has broadened the tent of people who are interested in soccer because it's such an easy game to pick up. And everybody knows the basic rules of soccer, even more so than, you know, playing a hockey game. Like, you don't have to have ever seen a soccer game to understand what you're trying to do. It's pretty straightforward. But that being said, you know, there are people who are FIFA obsessives, and they have all their favorite teams and their favorite players, and they've never actually seen those teams play. You know, they've never, because until recently, it wasn't that easy to be able to decide you wanted to watch, you know, all of the Bundesliga teams play.
Right.
Now, if you have cable, you can do that. But 3 years ago, that wasn't really an option. So it's a great example of how, you know, games have created a point of entry where there was a lack of access in the past, whether it was because you couldn't watch the games or because it was hard to understand them or you didn't have a community of people who had a shared interest in it. They've created that access point. And, when I try to think about what comes next, it's so challenging to figure out what the next big step in sports games is because it already seems like they're so realistic. And each year, the improvements now, when you look at like the big feature that they roll out in Madden every year, it's some tiny little marginal improvement about, you know, controlling the swim moves of the defensive lineman or something like that, because it's already so close. So, you know, I'll be fascinated to see, because I think even 15 years ago, probably I would have said the same thing. Like, oh, well, they've already got all the players. They've already got all these plays that you can run. What else could they possibly do?
Right.
I will wait with bated breath to find out what comes
next.
Well,
yeah, I think it's great. And just to follow real quickly, I think that we've seen not only people get interested. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that the soccer video games and FIFA video games has increased awareness of FIFA and soccer in general. But I think that when I was young in like 1986, I found a book about rotisserie baseball. Computers weren't doing it yet. We didn't have the internet yet, but people were doing it on paper. And there's a really great 30 for 30 that's one of the funniest documentaries I've ever seen about fantasy baseball and its origins. The name escapes me right now, but it's just a brilliant and very funny documentary. But I think that the NFL owes a lot of its popularity to the fact that fantasy football came around, and starting in the late 90s, you see the boom in football take off the same way that you see the boom in the internet take off in fantasy football.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and how frequently do you hear random person X at your office that say, well, I don't really watch, but I keep track of, you know, my fantasy football team, and I, you know, I keep up with with when my players are playing.
Yeah.
And that was unheard of when I found that book at the bookstore about rotisserie baseball and the first guys. I mean, only the nerdiest of the nerds would have that book even or know anything about fantasy baseball. Mm-hmm. And without the rise of the internet, it doesn't get as popular by any means. It got so much easier at that point. And so I think that what we see with video games, it's interesting because, like you're saying, Matt, with every other video game, it's outside of sports, it's to get less realistic and to get more fantastic. Mm. But with sports video games, we go the exact opposite way. To the point now, I had the, we've got a Wii U, but I had the Wii Fit for the Wii. Mm. And I loved the Wii Fit. It had boxing that I could do. It had step aerobics. And so obviously I think that where we're headed is going to be playing the sports in some ways, right? I mean, that's
what I wanted to get away from in the first place. I already know I'm lousy.
But this will help you. This will enhance your ability. And I think that that's a great place to leave off this segment is it's kind of coming full circle where we did. We started playing the games to get away from the fact that we didn't play so well in real life. And now I'm using the Wii Fit so that I can at least throw a punch occasionally, do my step aerobics. Next up on Can't Wait, it's Mother's Day, and so we're going to talk about our favorite TV moms of all time.